Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am really delighted to be joined today by Katherine Heine. She's the author of Standard Deviation and Single Carefree Mellow, and her short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and many other magazines. And her new novel is called Early Morning Riser, and it is just a joy. So welcome, Katherine.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with Lori Colwin, because you have just written a new introduction to a new edition of Happy All the Time. And I feel like there is going to be a great resurgence of Lori Colwin in the discourse. And it's so very clear how influenced by her you've been.
She's really amazing. And I first started reading her when I was maybe 20 years old and just starting to think about becoming a writer. And I think one of the beauties of Lori Colwin is you can read her at any point in your life and you feel like she's speaking about that particular time. And she just says so many things that are true, but they're funny because they're true, like about how her favorite moment of any dinner party is the moment when everyone leaves. She's very special to me. Her work is amazing.
And I feel like her name has come up a lot when I've given out book recommendations, and people have a desire, which I understand so much, to read something joyful and to read something that is not gonna bring them down. And it's hard to find lots of great books that do that. And so her name first came up. And then your name follows.
Oh, how flattering.
Yeah. So talk to me about that. Like, tell me about writing quote unquote uplifting books that aren't corny and that they're true to life, but there's a happy tint to them.
Well, I didn't start out to write a book that was really going to be warm and happy. I just started writing about these characters, but I became so invested in them, and they were so important to me, and it was almost like they were real people, and I wanted only good things for them. So even though there's a lot of adversity in their lives, my husband was talking about some TED talk about how video games are actually a good metaphor for life, because in a video game, you don't go to the next level, or you don't finish the game by rising straight up. So the graph is very bumpy and you fall in creeks and you get killed by people, and there are dangers everywhere, and that's what makes video games addictive and enjoyable. And it's the same way with life. You don't go straight from A to Z. I mean, I guess some really lucky
people I don't know them
do. But so in writing the book, I really wanted to write about Jane, the main character, and how she sort of gets what she wants, but in a very different form, and how maybe that's better. Mm-hmm. And I think that Colwin does a lot with the book that I wrote the introduction to, is Happy All the Time, which I would be scared to call a book Happy All the Time for fear that all the book critics would be like, I was unhappy all the time I was reading this. But Lori Colwin was very fearless. And so really that book is she states in the first few pages, these are the two cousins, and this is the story of how they get married. And it's sort of almost throwing down a gauntlet to the reader, being like, but it's going to be good, so keep reading. Her confidence is really, really amazing.
Yeah. And I love how in Early Morning Riser, I can see the video game aspect of it, in that you start in the year 2002, and then you kind of check in on these characters every couple of years. And one of the joys of reading the book is finding out where they are and what's happened to them and how their goals have changed in the meantime?
Well, the structure of the book was sort of accidental because I was writing and then I kept coming up against sort of structural issues of like, wow, I want this to be, I know that when Jane and Duncan break up, she goes 2 years before they get back together. And there was a certain amount of time I wanted Jimmy to live on his own. And I knew right from the start that Jane was gonna have children. So eventually it just became like, I was like, I'm getting so confused. I have to write this all down. And I also had to write everybody's ages because I'm really, really bad at math. So originally I had a piece of paper that said the year they were born, but literally like Duncan would be born in 1960 and it'd be the year 2000. And I'd be like, I have no idea how old he is. I have to look this up. My math skills are so bad. So that kind of became one of the pleasures of writing it was, as you say, like checking back in with them. And there were times where information that stuff that happened between chapters, I kind of wanted to include, like I knew it, but there was no way to fit it in. So it sort of forced me to be a little more editorial, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, choosing what to tell us and what to leave out must, I mean, I imagine that with these characters, you've created a whole world that they live in. And choosing what to tell us is an art. And I love the idea of course, you couldn't call any book right now happy all the time, partly because I think people would call you out for saying this isn't a happy book or no one's happy all the time. And that's the point of the title, right? Like, yeah, exactly. In Early Morning Riser, of course, Jane and Duncan and Jimmy, the three main characters, I would say, do not have perfect lives and they are faced with challenges all the time and life is unfair, but you give them such optimism or you give the reader such optimism in reading about them. Tell me about that.
I think a lot of it is that they have no other choice. Like, what are they gonna do? Just stop existing? And I think that Duncan is a flawed character, or he has many areas for improvement.
Sure.
As a person. But I think one of his really great qualities is he's really, really flexible. He just goes with what he makes the decision and he does it. And that's why I think he ends up being a really good husband.
He likes doing errands.
I know.
Who even? And I like that in the world of the book, Jane can meet Duncan and you would know the age difference better than I. But in the world of the book, no one's talking about power and differences or, you know, is it appropriate that he's dating a younger woman? Like, this is just assumed that he's like, that this relationship is solid. Fair?
Assumed by other people?
Yeah.
Or assumed by the reader?
The reader.
I think the reader probably questions it more. That the whole of Boyne City knows that Duncan is like this serial monogamist. And it's only Jane that thinks this is gonna be different. So I think probably the town approves of her being young because they're like, she'll have her years with Duncan and then she'll move on and she'll still be young enough to find somebody else, somebody who will actually marry her.
And tell me about Boyne City and bringing to life a town full of my favorite kind of small town, full of quirky, funny individuals who, yeah, are sometimes judgmental.
Well, I grew up in Michigan and we always went on vacation in or near Boyne City. And then when I got married, my husband and I lived abroad for many years. But we still came back to Michigan, and we decided to buy a house there, to sort of so our sons would have some stability. Mm-hmm. My older son was in the second grade before he went to the same school twice, like, because we moved so much. I'm like, I'm sorry. So it became this. So we began spending every summer there. So it became really like we lived the whole year in the time span of a summer. I'm not saying that very articulately.
No, but that makes sense.
It's this really beautiful small town, and it's on Lake Charlevoix, and there are many beaches, and I think the sunsets there are the most beautiful of anywhere in the world. And actually, when I finished the book, I had to go back through and take out like some sunsets because there were
too many sunsets.
Every other page. But it has such special meaning to me. And both my sons took their first steps there when they were babies. And my younger son took his first steps in a bar. Actually in the Sportsman, which is talked about in the book.
Yeah.
And it was during the daytime. It was, you know, it wasn't quite, it was more wholesome than it sounds. Although later we were like, he probably just wanted to walk so he didn't have to crawl on the super sticky beer soaked floor. But it's very much a small town in that it's just a slower pace of life. I shouldn't even say slower. It's a more gracious pace of life. And there's a lot of patience. And one year my sons interviewed at Boyne City Pizza. And the manager asked my older son how fast he was on a scale of 1 to 10. And my son thought about it for a long time and said, maybe a 5.5. And he still got the job.
Anything higher than a 5 at that point.
I know, I was pretty impressed. I'm like, ooh, I might not even go that high. But, and there's so many things, like on the 4th of July, everybody goes down to the beach, to Peninsula Beach, to watch the fireworks. And there's a beach and there's a playground and it has a merry-go-round. And on the 4th of July, like 70 kids get on it and the big kids push it till it's going like so fast. It's like a class action lawsuit in the form of a merry-go-round. But it was something my sons looked forward to and talked about the whole year. It was like 4th of July in Boyne City. I don't feel like I'm describing it accurately. It's such a lovely place. It's so dear to me.
Well, I mean, I certainly get that impression from reading the book, and your generosity to your characters, who then in turn are so generous in their time and their worldviews is just, I guess that's a huge part of having a book feel warm. I'm in New York City right now, and my life is fast-paced, even though it's mostly from my home right now. And there is something so calming about being inside the world of your book and being in this small town in Michigan. And you evoke that. Tell me a little bit about, from a craft perspective, how to convey that kind of everyday generosity, I guess.
It really was like, when every summer when we would go there, it was really like a sort of transition, or like you sort of enter this other dimension. And I remember one year we were living in London and we went to Boyne City, and the first day we went to this barbecue restaurant downtown, and we drove and we were like 9 blocks away. And I was like, there's a parking space. We have to take it. Like, they have a parking lot. And if they don't, there's like 100 spaces. But I was so caught up in London, which is just like, you know, you think about parking legit all the time. And there's this sort of thing that happens in Boyne City where people talk all the time about the neighboring towns.
Yeah.
And they're always like, oh, she works over in Charlevoix, or he's the teacher over in Manistee. And I've never lived anywhere where that was such a thing. And it's almost like people have to present their bona fides in a way. Like,
sure.
Like, they live in Boyne City, but they go shopping in Petoskey. There's this sort of difference. And we used to use a series of babysitters for my sons, just local teenage girls that we would hire. And one year, the one we wanted couldn't come for some reason, so she sent her sister, who was both younger and shorter than my boys, which was really, really funny. But like, as soon as we got to town and the boys were playing out in the yard, the babysitters would start calling us saying, I see you're back in town. Do you need a babysitter? There's very much this sense that people are keeping an eye on you. And there's very much a sense of everybody knows everybody else's business.
Sure.
And sometimes that's a good thing and sometimes that's a bad thing. And I think that's really something I exaggerated in the book for effect.
Yeah, I mean, I love that everyone moonlights in the book. So like, if you go to the store, you know the clerk from like three other places where they work.
I don't know that that's a real thing. That I just sort of came up with to make that day like a little bit more surreal for Jane, but it's definitely true for some extent.
Yeah, I was thinking about how I would hate for this movie, I mean, for this book to be adapted into a film, not because I would like for you to get a big payout. That's not what I'm saying, but like your descriptions of the characters and their clothing are so peculiar that I almost feel like it would ruin it to actually have to see a person in the role of Jane, say. There's, especially in the beginning, there's an omniscient narrator who is telling us how Jane really looks in her thrift store outfits.
Yeah, I like to write about what people are wearing a lot,
mm-hmm.
which is hilarious considering I wear yoga pants and a sweatshirt every single day of my life. One of my favorite books is Gone with the Wind. And early on in Gone with the Wind, Scarlett tries on all these dresses and like rejects them one by one. And that's really one of my favorite scenes. So I like to write about what people are wearing and I like to write about what people are eating.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes
I have to edit those things down a little bit, but sort of as when I was starting to write the novel, that was when my real love of thrift stores was born. Mm-hmm. So one of the great things about writing a novel is that you start to see the world through the lens of your novel, because yeah. I was like, well, I like thrift stores, so Jane will like them, and that will be really great.
And I was never entirely sure if this omniscient narrator was being accurate. Like, I kept thinking like there's what Jane thinks she looks like and what the narrator says she looks like. And then there's probably a third of what she really looks like, quote unquote, to the reader.
Yeah, I think that the omniscient narrator is almost like if Jane were narrating the book, as a dual role as a character and the narrator, because I feel that narration is so close to Jane.
Yeah.
That it's almost impossible to separate that. But there are a couple of times where, like, there's a time where she wears a sort of, I think it's like a velvet black pantsuit at her store, and the narrator says she looks sort of like an undertaker. And I just think that's really true. When you go back and look at photos, you're like, wow, I thought I looked great that night. What was up with, you know, this weird ribbon? So, and I also wanted it to be, I wanted to, Jane's looks to be, you know, a little bit up and down. I wanted her to be real.
Mm-hmm. And then in contrast, Duncan's ex-wife, Aggie, is just perfectly elegant. And her outfits, tell me about her. Tell me about how you came up with her look and how she would be.
Well, it's really weird because Aggie is a really bossy, passive aggressive character. And she sort of came into my mind fully formed and like bossing me around. And there was something, there's a line that she said a certain way near the end of the book that was slightly ungrammatical, and every copy editor flagged it, and I kept saying it's intentional, and you know, finally they were like, this is really distracting everybody, I think you should change it. I'm like, Aggie will be mad at me, okay? I've heard Aggie say this. So she, you know, just in when I was first writing it, she showed up. I made her a real estate agent just as a sort of arbitrary, I'm like, she needs a career. Mm-hmm. And then that became such a big part of her character and her arc through the novel. And I wanted her to be not the opposite of Jane in looks, because they're both blondes.
Yeah.
And, I felt it would be too easy if I made Aggie just like, you know, the complete opposite. And
the Veronica to her Betty.
Aggie is, oh, sorry, what did you say?
I said the Veronica to her Betty.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I think that Aggie is actually prettier than most people think because her bossiness stands in the way of her attractiveness.
Yeah. But she's a great cook.
She's a great cook, and she winds up being like sort of a good friend. Like I wound up
not sort
of Aggie, although she would drive me so crazy.
I mean, so Jane and Duncan acquire this kind of chosen family,
mm-hmm.
and there are some weirdos in the group. But you endow just about all of them with some sense of grace, perhaps. Like even Jane's mother is like as close as you can get to like a straight villain, and yet she also has her moments.
I really liked Jane's mother. A lot of people I know have not liked her. to me, Jane's mother and Gary and Jane's daughter, Patrice,
mm-hmm.
they were like gifts I gave myself. Like whenever there was a reason for them to be on the page, I was so happy. Like they can be funny. And I guess it was very important to me that Jane's mother have a little bit of redemption as a character.
Yeah. And Gary is just like, I was trying to diagnose him. There's some OCD in there.
Yeah. It was after my agent read the book, she was like, what exactly is wrong with Gary? And I said that I think he'd been infantilized by living with Aggie for so long.
Mm.
But I think it's also, it was very important to me to include the line where Jane says, nobody really knows what's wrong with Gary. It's sort of part of the small town thing of mm-hmm. like, Gary's just Gary. And everybody deals with him. And thank God we're not married to him.
Just keeping track of his likes and dislikes would be emotionally exhausting.
Well, early on, I showed a chapter to a friend of mine, and he said that he thought that Aggie talked about Gary's likes and dislikes as a way to make Gary sound more interesting than he is. And so that made me want Gary to have like even more likes and dislikes.
I love it.
And definitely there's a chapter in the book where Jane has to care for both children plus Jimmy plus Gary. And it was never a consideration for me not to have Gary there as somebody she had to take care of.
and that's like, you know, that's like a real climax of the book to have poor Jane. Let's talk about Jimmy just for a moment, because we haven't really gotten to him yet. And Jimmy starts as Duncan's assistant in his workshop, and he's mentally disabled. But once again, you don't go that much more into detail about what the doctors say or like what his prognosis is.
Well, I think that was deliberate, because mm-hmm. I think that Jimmy grew up in such a small town and at a time where people were not about diagnosing intellectual disabilities or learning disabilities. It was like the whole town calls Jimmy slow learning.
Right.
And that's not for most people. That's all we need to know. And Jimmy sort of came about accidentally in the first chapter, because I knew that Duncan runs this woodworking business, but I knew from the start he would be really sort of hopeless at it and only do the parts that he wanted to. And I wanted him to have an assistant, but I was like, well, he's not going to have a real go-getter assistant, because
right. The
place is barely functional. So it came to me that he would have this sort of slow learning guy. And then Jimmy just sort of took over the book from there. And it was very, very important to me that Jimmy be a kind and decent, complex person worthy of love, that he wouldn't, that the town has not seen him accurately all these years. They've only seen him as slow learning, and he's so much more than that.
And that's what a part, and such a big part of ableism, is to see someone just as their disability.
Yeah.
And I love how through Jane, we can kind of pin our hopes and dreams for him. And then we can kind of be pulled back in Through Jane, the reader can kind of project their hopes and dreams for Jimmy. And then we can be pulled back a little bit to see that it's okay if his hopes and dreams aren't the same. That what we and Jane want for him is not relevant to his emotional life.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that at least I had to learn as a parent. Is like, I remember my husband and I going to tour a school that we were thinking of sending the boys to, and like we left and we were all, you know, jazzed up about it and how great it was, but like on the drive home we realized we would have loved to go there as students, because that's the kind of students we were, but would our boys love that? Maybe not. And right. I think it's very hard as a parent not to assume your children are just like you and are going to have the same hopes and dreams. And I think that, you know, Jane does become Jimmy's mother in so many ways. I think that's part of what she goes through. And I also think that she's maybe a better mother to her own daughters, because she's had the practice with Jimmy.
Right. Right. Well, Catherine, this has been so wonderful. Before we go, will you recommend some books for us?
Oh, I would love to. And one actually has this very funny story of, I went to college at the University of Kansas. And a couple months ago, I was on Facebook on my phone, and it said, people you might know. And there was this tiny little thumbnail, a picture of a guy. And I was like, oh my God, I sat behind him in history class at KU, and he had the most beautiful handwriting. And then I saw him drunk at a party in an elevator, and I told him he had the most beautiful handwriting, and he just looked like scared to death. So I reached out to him on Facebook, and I was right. That's who he was, and or is, I should say. And, it turns out that he's a poet, and he has a book of poetry coming out in June called Worldly Things. And it's so good, and it's luminous, and it's sad, and it's funny, and it makes you think. It's like all the things that poetry should be and sometimes isn't. So I really can't recommend it enough. His name is Michael Cleaver Diggs. And it's also a way that KU is still enriching my life.
Aww.
All these years later. I also read a book for the first part of lockdown. I could only read The Little House on the Prairie.
Fair.
And then I read Notes on a Silencing by Lacey Crawford.
Yeah.
And it was so beautifully written and so haunting and so inspiring and so everything that it sort of single-handedly pulled me out of my Little House on the Prairie reading song. And I fangirled completely all over her Facebook page, and she was so lovely and so gracious. And I think everybody should read that book. It's so amazing.
Yes.
Have you read it?
Yes. She's been a guest on this show, in fact, and she is amazing. She really is.
And then the other book I really liked sort of recently within the last year is Exciting Times by Nisha Dolan.
Mm.
It's just really, really funny. It made me laugh out loud in a lot of places. And I would sort of follow my husband around the house reading parts out to him, even if he had his headphones on. And this is so good, I have to read it out loud.
Well, that's what I did to my husband with your book. So I think that's perfect.
Well, no higher compliment.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Anytime. This was really great, really fun.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.